Welcome to this afternoon's edition of At the Root of It. It's September 1st, and this is Aaron Fitzpatrick recording out of Roberta's studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We're going to start today's show with the Week in Wine recap and with breaking news this afternoon. Diageo boss Paul Walsh has admitted that the UK drinks multinational is keen to buy Moët Hennessy, but only if the price is right. Rumors have been surfacing since April that Diageo, which already holds a 34% stake in its French rival, would be interested in acquiring the remaining 66% company if 66% is granted. I think it is quite likely that the acquisition will happen, and probably imminently, as Diageo has no champagne or cognac brands in its portfolio. And for the crop report today, Bordeaux producers, as well as Burgundy producers alike, are cautiously optimistic that the 09 vintage will be comparably good as the 2005 vintage after a dry and warm growing season. Going as far as to compare it to 2005, expectations are high, and following a dry and warm summer, they're looking for a little rain in September, which wouldn't hurt. Producers report red varieties are maturing faster than usual on both the left and the right bank, so that the harvest of Merlot may be earlier than expected, as early as the 15th of September. Let's hope that they're right and that the 09 vintage is just as good as the 05, but doesn't command quite as high prices. And the market feed this afternoon. Premium wine sales have been badly hit as customers rein in their spending, the world's largest drinks company Diageo has reported. Diageo, which owns wine brands including Barton & Guestier, Pied d'Or, and Blossom Hill, announced wine sales fell 5%, while its spirits division reported positive growth. The weakness of higher-priced wines in the U.S. was biggest contributor to the 5% overall decline in the wine category. This ties into the news that I reported last week regarding the glut of grapes in California and that wines above $25 have been hardest hit as consumers trade down and buy products in the $10 to $15 range. That sums it up for the Week in Wine. We're going to be right back with this afternoon's guest. Thank you for joining us. Welcome back to At the Root of It, broadcasting at Roberta's 4 p.m. Tuesdays every week. A quick thank you to our sponsor, Picnic, a delicious sandwich kiosk from Will Goldfarb, who also has a show on the network called Will Communication. I'm pleased to introduce today one of the strongest female forces, wine talent, in the New York industry, in my regard, Lee Campbell. Welcome, Lee.
Thank you, Aaron.
So you and I have both crossed paths in years past and even collaborated on a few events. And now you've landed a nice spot at Louis Dressner Selections.
Yes. As I was telling you before, I think I have the job of my dreams, although I don't know what that means for the rest of my life. But I'm in a really sweet spot right now. I work for the company I've always wanted to work for.
And can you tell us a little bit about Louis Dressner?
Yeah, Louis Dressner Selections. It's, one of the smallest companies in the business and probably one of the most powerful companies in terms of commitment and in terms of thought process and where they want to take the industry. You know, it was founded by a guy named Joe Dressner and his wife, Denise Louis. Joe from Queens, and every much the sort of Queens kind of quintessential guy. And Denise, born in the Macon and raised in Alsace. They met in journalism school, getting their master's at NYU. And when they realized they didn't really want to become journalists, they decided to try their hand at bringing wine into the country. The thing that's interesting to me about this company is that although we've become sort of synonymous with importing natural wines and sustainable wines and artisanal wines into the United States, largely from France, but now from Italy, Spain, and Portugal, they, you know, when they got into the business, they kind of had to learn their way through it like everyone else. And it wasn't for a few years that they sort of figured out what really drove them, which was this element of natural winemaking. So for the last, they've been importing wines for 20 years and probably committed to this genre of wines. Yeah, this genre of wines, you know, for between 10 and 15 years, I would say. And, you know, there were some mistakes made along the way, although, you know, I don't think huge regrets because things were learned all along. But now we find ourselves with this great company that is distributed nationally, although obviously our hubs are in, you know, sort of urban areas, you know, San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, New York City, Chicago. And we are specializing in wines that are made as close to the earth as possible.
Has the portfolio grown significantly in the past 5-10 years?
It has. People always think of us as a Loire importer. When I say Loire, I mean the Loire Valley of France, which is this beautiful winemaking area in north central France. But we bring in wines from all over France, and we also bring in wines from now all over Italy. And the natural wine movement is, you know, I think it kind of probably had, you know, politically anyway, it had sort of its origins, especially in the Loire Valley of France. But you have people doing good work all over the world at this point. And we are sourcing them out all over Italy and have even gone into the Rioja district of northern Spain.
Interesting. Who would you attribute, or who does Louis Dressner attribute to being some of those rock stars of terroir-driven wines from Loire? I know Didier Dagenot, who sadly passed away last year, was one of my favorites.
But well, yeah, he was a rock star in every aspect of that, because he lived passionately and he died passionately. But you know, there's probably Terry Puzzola, who's in the Touraine district, and Pierre Breton from Chinon.
Love those guys.
And but now I want to also think about other places. So, you know, we've, you know, gone into Italy in the last few years, and some of the producers out there are Angelino Maule, who is in the Suave district. He's doing amazing things in the area just outside of Venice. And young gal who I'm a little jealous of because she seems so focused at such a young age. She's about 26. Her name is Arianna Ocapinti, and she's she's just a brawler, and she's down in she's down in Sicily. So she's amazing.
And are they doing the Frappato?
That she does single variety Frappato, so just one variety called Frappato that mostly nobody has heard of, but it's absolutely delicious.
It's delicious.
And she does a Nero d'Avola as well, and she does a blend. But she's the kind of gal that whenever she comes to New York, all of the young male sommeliers fall in love with her immediately, and she has no idea how attractive and alluring she is. But you know, more important than how cute she is, she's making amazing wine. She grew up in a wine family, so she kind of, you know, had her her ear to the ground pretty early. But she's, you know, you can go in many, many different directions, even if you're given all the tools and the talent and the information. And she's decided to go into a very artisanal and natural direction, which is just, you know, amazing.
And you, having landed this job, you are a New York salesperson for Louis Dressner.
Yeah. After begging to work for the company for a few years, they finally agreed. And now I hawk wines because somebody's got to do it.
But you've been in various posts in the industry for many years, as long as I've known you. But
yeah. I mean, my first love was actually food and wine. It took a little while to get to me. I didn't grow up in a family that drank wine. We drank rum. We're West Indian. And I loved food. I knew that for a very long time. time. But I worked, front of the house, maitre d', managing, hostess. Eventually, I started to think maybe about going into the kitchen, but it was a bad idea. Everybody agreed. And finally, I started to take wine classes. So once I got into wine, it was clear to me that the old world was a little bit more where my heart was. So
right.
European wines really drove me. And one of my early jobs was at the Italian wine merchants, and I drank some really tremendous wines there. But then I moved on to other restaurants and other wine stores, probably most notably Chamber Street Wines, which is a bastion of Nastro wine sales here in New York, and then helped open a wine boutique in Harlem a few years later called Harlem Vintage, where we tried to also sell lots of natural wines.
Okay, so your heart was in that that area quite early on.
I was indoctrinated. I was drinking the Kool-Aid pretty early.
Well, then you segued into reopening of the Provence restaurant on McDougal Street.
Yeah.
And you had quite a nice selection of Provençal and Bendole. And
We tried to keep it, Provence was a difficult project because it was a restaurant that was there for a really long time. And so we kind of were in this sort of cultural purgatory. We were trying to make it modern, but at the same time, a little bit, kind of our hands were tied a little bit. And anyway, we did a wine list that was, all French with leanings towards Provençal wines, which were, for me, a lot of fun because I think Bandols are one of the great red wines of France and hugely overlooked.
Definitely.
Very, cellar worthy and deep and dark and earthy and really interesting wines. And I think that there's just in general a very high level of wines coming out of Provence. I think partially because it's so expensive to have land down there. You kind of have to really know what you're doing. But one of the things that's very interesting about Provence as a region is because of the Mistral, that classic cool wind that comes through on a seasonal basis, it keeps the vineyard sites and the grapes really dry and clean and healthy, and you can actually do more organic viticulture down there. So for me, that was a natural
The environment's working with the grapes on another level. Yeah,
exactly. And then, for the rest of the list, we just tried to flesh it out with just really kitschy, unique, artisanal wines. One of the producers that I used to carry on the list a few years ago at Provence was a producer called Damour, which is a very small but respected winemaker in Chablis. And now a few years later, we import those wines with Louis Dresser. I'm just so happy that things have come full circle. it's all worked out, and I try not to drink my sample bottles too much.
Do you think that there's been, given the movement this day and age with respect to sustainability and knowing where your source comes from and the growing interest from the consumer, that it has been an easier sell for the company in the past 5 years?
Yeah, I actually think it has. Erin and I are both relatively young women. And, wine was always such a really snotty thing for many years. And I remember when I first came to New York, all of the sommeliers were European.
Yeah.
And female sommeliers, oh my God. I mean, there was maybe Karen King at Union Square and Beth Von Benz, but there weren't that many female personalities, let alone people of color and different classes. I mean, we're in a really amazing time for sort of people feeling that they have the right to enjoy wine. And when you look at the landscape in New York, when you go into wine stores and you see the types of clientele and how varied the clientele can be, I'm very excited about that. So I think that once you start to get out of the box and you understand that the best wines don't just come from Burgundy and Bordeaux, that there are all these amazing other areas that you can get wines, and not just Napa and Sonoma, but, places like Mendocino and places like Uruguay and all points of the map, India, China making wines now too. Now I'm not saying they're great, but there's wines coming from everywhere. And so, now everybody feels like they have a little piece of it. And you see that when it comes to consumers, and you see that when it comes to the people who are buying the wines for the consumers, the wine buyers and the sommeliers. And so I think that just that equal sort of feeling that's going on, that sort of, democratic feeling that's going on right now, makes it better for wines like us, because we're the quintessential socialist wine company. We're kind of commies. We're not into wine as a commodity. Wine is something that you're not supposed to drink for many, many years. We're these are wines that are made close to the soil and they're really made for drinking now. And in the very, very extreme situation, put it down for a
few years and see what happens, or even put it down for 20 years. But for the most part, we're all about getting wines to the masses, but getting good, clean, natural, expressive, soulful wines to the masses. And so I think what's going on right now in general, in terms of consumers enjoying wines, I think this is good for our company. Now, you know, there's an economic climate, of course, we have to be aware of.
Of course. Yeah. We're going to get into that aspect as well before we take a quick break. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. My guest today is Lee Campbell, and we've started the conversation with respect to her work with Louis Dressner Portfolio and the biodynamic natural winemaking movement and climate at this time. For any listeners, if you'd like to call in, the number is 718-497-2128. I'll gladly take any of your calls. So just to continue speaking about the current state of the industry and this growing interest from the consumer's aspect of knowing where the source of the product that they're consuming comes from, it's kind of a ripe time for a portfolio like yours, Lee, that really is showcasing the work of artisanal hands and the art of winemaking to its purest sense. I think that in conversations past with some other people who are also involved in winemaking, either whether it's natural winemaking or they're involved in the selling aspect of it, there are some perceptions that the customer does have regarding organic, regarding biodynamic wines that can sometimes be difficult to debunk, if you will.
Sure.
There are a lot of people on the buying side where I feel like it's a calling to be able to communicate how good these wines are to to a consumer that's willing to listen. But to walk blindly into a store, often in a retail capacity, for instance, it's harder to make that sell in some ways. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the other day I was at Trader Joe's, and I hope I don't get in trouble for this, but I was at Trader Joe's, and you know, I bought some tortilla chips, and it said organic white tortilla chips. And of course, somebody like me, I said, I'm going to buy those. And I even want to buy them more now. But if you go into Trader Joe's adjoining wine store, that's not a selling point for them. And I'm sad that there's a disconnect. I think we work a little bit hard. We need to work harder at making sense of this. You know, I mean, wine at its purest and at its truest is an organic product, and it's an agricultural product. And to take that out of the mix is a disconnect for me.
Right.
But it's a challenge. challenge. I think it always has to do with wine being construed as this elitist luxury product, mm-hmm. and sort of being made into this mythical creature that it's not. I mean, I work with extraordinary wines, but if you come into my house and see what I drink on a regular basis, last night I was drinking Beaujolais Village, mm-hmm. I mean, out of a tumbler, mm-hmm, you know, with mm-hmm. some macaroni and cheese. Like, that's, you know, and that's, even to have wine out of a bottle is sort of a luxury, because traditionally, you know, traditional wine and wine making countries, they often just take a big jug down to the local winery and they fill it up and then they stick it in a cool, dark place and they just kind of drink out of this jug for a week.
And, yeah, sits on the table. And,
yeah. So even, you know, even having things under cork and in bottles, like, that's still kind of fancy,
right?
You know,
right.
So we need to debunk this, and we need to make sure that people understand that if they are subscribing to things like CSAs, if they are buying organically, if they are going to the green market, they should really be thinking about that similarly when they're buying wines,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And whatever compromises and sacrifices that they are comfortable making when they go to the green market, when they're buying organic products, if they look at an apple and it doesn't look perfect, but they bite into it and it's absolutely delicious, that's the same kind of thinking you need to bring to
right.
organic wines.
Right. Well, it's interesting too, because obviously the organic food comes at a premium,
mm-hmm.
and people are willing to pay that premium.
Yeah.
But when it comes to wine, it seems that there's a lot of people who aren't willing
yeah.
to pay that extra $3 per bottle.
Yeah.
And it's going into the same source. It's going
exactly.
into your body. But so why are they
unwilling to
pay?
It's the American puritanical disconnect.
Right.
I think that we always think we're doing something wrong when we're drinking. So
right.
therefore, we just give up altogether. But we, you know, for wine drinkers, I think especially, you know, they know deep down that this is a lifestyle choice. And they really have to keep that commitment up when they're drinking. I have a friend who is a green market loyalist.
Yeah.
She buys everything from the green market. She loves to show me the fruits and vegetables she gets every week. And then she plonked down a bottle of Mouton Cadet on the table, and I was horrified. Look, I, you know, Mouton Cadet, big party situation, or if you need some cooking wine.
Sure, yeah.
You know, but it
we'll put that in line with
yeah.
Concio Toro.
It's a little bit inconsistent with green market rainbow Swiss chard. So,
right.
You know, I'm not trying to call anybody out. We've all made choices that have been questionable at different times. But I'm just trying to encourage people to think about it,
right?
And to be willing to take the jump for organic wine. And the thing is that many of my producers don't even bill themselves as organic.
No.
If you go to the store, if you look at these bottles that we have in front of us, we have two lovely bottles from France and Italy in front of us, but they don't say organic. Well, I guess one does on the back. Let me take a look. One does on the back, but it's very sort of obscure.
Right.
And the other one, which is organic and biodynamic, doesn't say a thing. And that's because they really do want the wine to speak for themselves. They
right.
don't want you just to buy it because of it's organic. But
and
know,
it also, they go through much more processes and whatnot with
mm-hmm.
respect to trying to get that certification, which
yes.
oftentimes is not worth
yeah.
it. They're like, let the
you
product speak
that.
For themselves.
Exactly. At the end of the day, they really just want the wine to speak for itself. And I think it does most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, there has been a lot of tastings and a lot of companies putting on what they've coined the return to terroir movement,
yes.
if you will.
Yes.
And although it seems like that was quite popularized in you know, 70s and 80s as well, it's had a little bit of a rebirth in some ways in this decade.
Sure.
So do you feel like the portfolio that you're working with, it was one of the driving forces behind that kind of, not,
yeah.
I wouldn't say popularization, but in a way, I've been a buyer at rejuvenation.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a buyer at several restaurants myself, and I can speak to other people in similar situations or similar positions who want to go a little further and not take the easy route with respect to just buying from a larger company,
mm-hmm.
In order to support.
Yeah,
and it's important in your day to day to actually take the moments to taste and to, you know, as a buyer, take those sales calls and learn about what else is out there.
Yeah. I mean, I think what it does is it takes the ego out of it. It takes you out of this whole sort of, I don't know, process. And it does make you feel a little bit small. It makes you realize that the world was here before you. The world is going to be here after you. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. The terroir is king or queen, and we're just sort of friends, that friends of the earth that are trying to sort of transcribe it's sort of feeling and emotion and support from the earth. I mean, I think that's for us what it's about, is that we understand our place in this, and we don't want to make more of ourselves than we are. I mean, you know, and that's why sort of the idea of the superstar winemaker doesn't exactly set great with us, because for us, it's, you know, the winemaker is a conduit. It's not the end all be all.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With respect to the philosophy of the Dressner portfolio, when we go into our second segment, Lee's going to be joining us next week as well to do a tasting on air. Before we get into that segment, for the listeners who will continue to listen next week, the Dressner portfolio, as concise as it is, it's very consistent in that their winemaking methods are consistently in line with natural winemaking. What are those methods that are consistent?
Well, you know, we talked about one really important thing, which is terroir. It's that the terroir speaks, and that the terroir is, you know, celebrate it. So that one of the things that's really important to us is that we maintain grape varieties that are specific to each of the different climates that we work in, and that we're not encouraging people to pull up vines that may be less profitable so that they can plant things that people might recognize more. But, you know, obviously we're talking about no artificial or synthetic herbicides or pesticides in the fields. And very, very important to us is hand harvesting. Mm-hmm. We don't work with any winemakers that machine harvest. Obviously, once you go into the winery, there are still lots of things you can do. So just no outside interventionist additives or manipulations or high-tech procedures. I mean, our winemakers are working pretty low-tech, always hygienically, always clean, always focused, and sometimes very scientifically, but without using sort of the barrage of techniques and sort of high-technology techniques that are allowed these days. And then, as we talked about, very importantly is really not using any ambient or added yeast. All of our winemakers work with the naturally occurring yeast that are in their vineyards and in their cavs.
It's very impressive.
So that's something that is tricky. It's like making bread from a mother as opposed to using the little packets. And it's difficult, and you have to really be thinking ahead all the time about how you're going to proceed. But it creates wines that are terribly expressive of the terroir. The yeast is part of the terroir, so you can't really separate one from the other.
Sure, it exists on the grapes, it exists in the vineyards, and it's been interesting to speak to winemakers as well who don't use natural yeast and who might look at the aspect of using it as really kind of potentially hurting their business if they send something to market and there's a second fermentation happening in the bottle, which they don't know about and can no longer control. And
the thing that I would say, though, is that as you do this for many years, you do learn how not to send bottles to market that are inappropriate.
Right.
You do figure out what are the right things to do and how to handle your grapes and how to handle your must. And so it takes time, like anything does. Mm-hmm. But you know what? It takes time. It's worth the time.
Right.
And then lastly, for us, it's really a minimal use of sulfur. We are all for sulfur in appropriate amounts. So, you know, some of our winemakers choose not to use sulfur. And again, it's a technique that is sometimes very risky, but if you know what you're doing, you can produce beautiful wines. But we're all for people adding a little bit of sulfur, but not overdoing it. So it's just, you know, a very light hand to make sure that the wines get to market in one piece, but that you don't open them and they're, you know, kind of in this frozen state from sort of too many additives and too many preservatives.
Have you had any experiences with respect to the wild yeast where you've opened a bottle and all of a sudden there's been something happening in there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, to be fair, you know, it takes winemakers sometimes many years to figure out what to do right. And there's two producers I will speak of because I'm so proud of where their wines have come. But Renee Moss, who's a producer in the Anjou in the Loire Valley, and then also Darden Ribot, which is a Northern Rhone producer in the South. These are two producers I've been watching for about about, I don't know, 8 to 10 years. And that was because for whatever reasons, very early in my career, before I worked for this company, I used to try their wines a lot. And I used to love their wines, but, you know, every now and then you would get a bottle that was just a wackadoo. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just like, oh, I can't drink this. It's fizzy. It's crazy. I don't want to touch it. But then, of course, you would get to another bottle that was beautiful and wonderful, and it changed your life. Now, fast forward about 8 years, I'm now selling these wines. You know, I'm selling these wines as this distributor and the importer. And now they're nearly seamless.
Yeah.
And this doesn't have to do with a change of what their philosophies were. They're still working organically. They're still working with no sulfur. They're still working biodynamically, but their technique has been honed.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a learning process that just has come over vintage to vintage to vintage. So you know, if you want to be this kind of winemaker, you're not, it's not about the money. It's not about a glamorous lifestyle. It's not about,
it's heart and soul and, yeah.
It's about being a farmer.
Right.
And,
right. Well, it's nice that for so many years you've supported these same winemakers after 20 years, and now, you know, yeah, they've come into really their own.
Well, so I think a lot of times if you do get into this part of the wine business, it's the wines choose you as much as you choose them. So these wines had a lot to say to me when my palate was developing, and now we're talking to each other,
right,
you know, at a different phase in my life. So yeah.
Well, we're going to get a chance to taste some of the wines from Lee's portfolio from Dressner in next week's show. I'm going to wrap it up this afternoon. So thank you for joining us on this glorious Tuesday.
Thanks, Erin.
Thank you to our sponsor again, Picnic, Will Goldfarb, and to our producers and engineer, Lorenzo Ragioneri and Nat Wiener. Have a great afternoon.